kids on the block had a bunch of hits. Chinese food makes me sick, and I think it's fly when girls stop by for the summer. It is The Blitz. Mitch Widmeyer here with you on AM 1450 KATE, Monday to Friday, 2:30 to 4. Going to the phone lines, our guest today. Always love having our next guest on when he graces us with his presence. It's Jim Sonnis. He's a writer and a podcaster for Number Fire. Jim, as always, the time is appreciated. I went with that song. I believe we're around the same age, if not the exact same age. That was one of the songs that I remember hearing in like my mom's car when I was like 5 or 6 years old. Do you remember that one at all?
I have never heard of it in my entire life, I don't think.
Are you kidding
me? I was
trying
to figure out what it was when it was playing, but I could not honestly identify it.
Summer Girls by LFO. I think they were one of those, you might not have heard of it before, because I've never really heard of LFO outside of that song. They might have been like a one-hit wonder. But I'm how old are you?
I am 26.
Okay, so you're a year older than me then. But yeah, we were around that same age. I just remember hearing that one. Maybe my mom just listened to different music. I don't know.
I listened to more oldies stuff. Like,
okay.
I was a big Stevie Wonder guy, a lot of Santana in there. So I loved K, working at K because it allowed me to listen to, you know, the older stuff, which I enjoyed more. So I think that was the draw for me. And I guess I might have missed out on an entire wave of music because of it.
You and Daryl, though, probably gelled perfectly when it came to music interest at times, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I liked working with Daryl, too, because he knew so much stuff that just, like, confounded me. Like, it was like he was like just this giant dictionary of knowledge that I had never tapped into before. Because, like, I listened to the music and stuff, but like I never knew like the backstory behind it. So like listening to Daryl was always just like so eye-opening for me, and I loved it. I learned so much there. It's just so much that I never knew, even though I had listened to the music literally my entire life.
Daryl is a wealth of knowledge. We are relying on you to be the wealth of knowledge for us today, and we'll start with the Twins. They sold a little bit at the deadline. It seemed to make all the sense in the world to deal Brandon Kinstler, 32 years old. I said his stock will never be higher. He's a free agent at the end of the year. That move made sense, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you don't need a closer on your team when you are not really in contention. And I know the Twins, they're still kind of hanging on, but in reality, like, that's not going to be a thing. So you don't need a closer. He'll be a free agent at the end of the year. If you really like him, go ahead and just sign him again then. But, I mean, the thing with Kinstler is it's hard to have an immense ceiling as a reliever when you don't get strikeouts. And he's a great reliever. Like, I'm not trying to take that away from him. Having the ground ball rate that he has is awesome, and he's a very good pitcher. But you're never going to be Kenley Jansen, Zach Britton, a guy like that, if you don't get strikeouts. And that's not really part of Kinstler's game. So I think it was smart to move like they did. The Washington Nationals obviously have a huge need in their bullpen, even after getting Sean Doolittle and Ryan Madsen. So it was just a good fit for the two teams. The Twins had a guy who was very good and could be moved elsewhere. They got a guy who seemed interesting in the low minors in return. So, I mean, why not? You know, it made sense for both sides to kind of pull the trigger on that one for sure.
The other piece dealt away by Thad Levine and Derek Falvey, Jaime Garcia. He didn't even get to start a game at Target Field. You can't even say he got a cup of tea in Minnesota before being dealt to New York.
Yeah, I mean, that was fun. It was a fun run for old Jaime Garcia with the Twins. I enjoyed it, I know, watching that one start. And we'll always have that memory of Jaime Garcia. And honestly, I think the Twins, it's kind of like a joke that they decided to trade him, but they honestly made out pretty well in giving up what they did. They gave up a guy in the low minors, and what they got in return is Zach Littell. I think it's Little. I don't know if it's Littell or Little, but regardless, like, the guy they got in return in Double-A for the Yankees had a 29.7% strikeout rate in his starts at Double-A this year. It's after doing pretty well in Single-A, too. And what they've got now is they've got three really good pitchers in Double-A between Steven Gonsalves, Fernando Romero, and this Zach Little guy, and they're all around 21 or 22 years old. Like, these are guys who will be in the rotation potentially midway through next year. I guess it could be even earlier than that, I don't know. But these are three really good pitchers in Double-A right now. And so to give up what they did to acquire Garcia and then getting a guy like Little in return, that's really solid. So I know it's kind of a laughingstock that the Twins traded Garcia so quickly after getting him, but honestly, the net game for them was really solid.
The two names that stood pat with the Twins that were also being rumored heavily were Irvin Santana, more so than Brian Dozier, but both of those names, Santana, Dozier, were flirted around with. If the price was right, Jim, would you have been okay with the Twins sending away Irvin and or Brian Dozier? Or do you view either of them as an integral part of the future for the Twins?
Yeah, I think I would have been very much more okay with Santana than Dozier. Santana specifically because it's kind of like you were talking about with Kinsler, where I'm not sure his value will ever be higher. Santana's 34 years old, and the one thing he had done well, so well, throughout the early start of the season was, you know, preventing hard contact for opposing batters. We've kind of seen that slip away from him a bit here recently. If you look at the month of July, he allowed a 41% hard hit rate. The league average is around 32%. His was 31% in June. It was 24% in May. So he had fallen off pretty steadily there. And to me, that's a big concern. So I honestly would have accepted a little bit of a lower deal in order to move Santana, just because it does seem as if the thing that he was doing so well earlier in the year is no longer in place. So between those two guys, I would have been much more willing to move Santana, just because it seems like he is kind of on the decline right now in season and also in general, because, again, he's 34 years old. With Dozier, I kind of understand why they didn't. They can still trade him during this offseason if they want to do so. His stock not necessarily as high as it was before, and he's a guy who can go on these just disgusting tears where he just puts, you know, 10 dingers in the seat in a month. So I think it was smart to keep Dozier. I fully back that. I probably would have been pretty itchy to move Santana personally, just because of the batted ball data trending the direction that it is. But Dozier, I'm totally fine with keeping him.
Jim Sonnis, our guest this afternoon here on the Blitz AM 1450 KATE, writer, podcaster for Number Fire. I know Twins fans, some have been a bit frustrated lately with the lack of wins, quite frankly. And I had said, Jim, that I get it, I understand, but man, like 2 weeks away from the deadline, there were legitimate conversations being had as to whether the Twins should buy or sell. And I don't know who foresaw that at the beginning of the year. I'm not going to go out of my way to say like the Twins have spoiled us this year, but I thought they were playing a lot better than what I had sort of forecasted for them. There were legitimate conversations, dialogues going on about, man, should they maybe buy and try to pick up a piece? And some thought they might be going down that path when they got Jaime Garcia, and they were, if they kept him, we're going to put him in the middle of the rotation. So I think I get the frustration, but the Twins have been better than I expected them to be.
Yeah, same here. Absolutely. And I think that Derek Wetmore, I believe it was, the 1500 ESPN, put it really well, where this is kind of the ideal scenario for Minnesota, where they contended long enough to keep people interested, you know, and I mean, you know, exceed expectations. They've had some younger pieces perform really well, like Miguel Sano, like Jose Barrios. They've had some younger guys who have been awesome. And then they also fell out of contention in time where they could still shed off some assets like Brandon Kinsler, like Jaime Garcia, like John Ryan Murphy, frankly, as well. They were able to get rid of some guys and net some prospects in return. So I kind of view this as being the best possible scenario for Minnesota, because realistically, their winning window doesn't really open until like 2019 or 2020. The flood Miguel Sano here, Byron Buxton will still be here. A lot of their best assets will still be here. And then you'll have those younger pitchers up in the majors too. So they should not be operating as if 2018 is their year to win. It should be focused on 2019, 2020, and if they win in 2018, great. You know, in 2017, that's fine. That's awesome. And it's going to be a lot more fun if they do so. But realistically, their peak years are going to come after next year, essentially. So I'm excited for this. I think that it's kind of, like I said, the ideal scenario here with the way things played out. Just kind of let the young guys play, get Byron Buxton in there every day, get Max Kepler in there against lefties even, you know, let him see what he can do there, and just see how much you can develop them heading into 2018. And if you're in contention in 2018 at this point, then I say bye. You know, at that point, go ahead, because you're closer to your winning window. But for this year, I think they made the right move. I think you kind of had to, you know, pull back, see what's realistic, and try to beef up for the future.
These last couple of months, who do you want to see or who needs to finish strong for you to feel more comfortable about their prospects moving into next season? Is it Byron Buxton perhaps topping that list?
Yeah, it's going to be Buxton. It's always going to be Buxton. This team kind of centers around him just because of what he can be if he figures things out offensively. And honestly, before he got hurt, he was getting there. If you look at his numbers since, I think it's June 18th, he has a 35% hard hit rate, which is above average, and his strikeout rate in that time is just 24%. So if you combine those two numbers with what he can do defensively, what he can do on the base pass, it's a really solid asset. So honestly, you know, getting hurt for him came at the worst possible time. But even when he came back, you know, he had another hard hit ball yesterday, a couple of strikeouts is disappointing. But overall, I think that I'm pretty optimistic about what I've seen from Buxton from the middle part of June on, and I want to see what he can do down the stretch. I'm pretty optimistic. I've been overly high on him to a fault for a very long time now, but I think we're starting to see signs that it is turning around. So I think if they can get him hot like they did last year, where he finished September so well, then they could be looking at a pretty nice ball club heading into 2018 between him, Sano, Kepler, and others.
Plenty of baseball chatter this afternoon with Jim Sonnis, podcaster, writer for NumberFire. Let's zoom out the microscope, look from a league-wide perspective at other things going on. Yu Darvish gets traded at the deadline to the Dodgers. Everyone's jumping on that hype train. I'll ask you, how awesome is it going to be when the Cubs beat the Dodgers in the NLCS this year?
It's not going to be, because we don't talk about unrealistic situations. And unrealistic, just kind of pulling your leg there. But I mean, if we look at NumberFire's power rankings here for Major League Baseball, right now the Dodgers are first. They have a projected win record of 109-53, and every projection system is going to be conservative, because you can have a guy like Corey Seager, like Cody Bellinger, they can get hurt and it will tank everything. So projection systems are always going to be conservative, and the conservative estimate for the Dodgers right now is 109 wins in the regular season. The Cubs have been awesome ever since, you know, the All-Star break. They've been playing really good baseball. But when you put that rotation up against the likes of Clayton Kershaw, Yu Darvish, if Alex Wood can turn things back around, he's in there as well. Rich Hill's been awesome. Kenta Maeda is the king. So, you know, there's just so much there with the Dodgers, plus Kenley Jansen in that offense, where it's really hard for me to see a scenario in which they don't wind up winning the National League. And obviously, it's August. We can't. There are no certainties, but they're too good for me to pick against them right now.
You mentioned it's only August, but I'm curious, the numbers you guys have at NumberFire, are they pointing in the direction of a Dodgers-Astros World Series?
Yeah, so right now the Dodgers have the best World Series odds, and this is to win the World Series, not just to get there, but they have the best World Series odds at 26.7%, so fourth basically, and the Astros are second at 22.4%. There's no one else above 15%. It's Cleveland, followed by Washington after that, and then the Cubs are in fifth, so it's pretty, you know, a pretty big gap between the Dodgers and the Astros and everyone else. So I would kind of, you know, assume at this point that that's the baseline assumption. Those two will be there. Cleveland, if they can get healthy, especially in their rotation, could make a good push against Houston. But for right now, it really does seem like it's the Dodgers and the Astros, followed by everyone else.
I was just going to ask you about Cleveland, because I view them as a party wrecker, perhaps, to the likes of the Houston Astros, but they can't ever stay healthy, Jim. In the latest, Josh Tomlin out for 6 weeks, Andrew Miller put on the disabled list as well. It's always someone getting nicked up, and a lot of times, I remember last year heading into the playoffs, it always seems to be going on with their pitching, whether it's the rotation or the bullpen.
It's looking on the flip side, too, because they did just get Danny Salazar back. He's made two starts since coming back, and his swinging strike rate in those two starts is 20%. And the league leader in that mark right now is 16% for Corey Kluber. It's the percentage of pitches that get whiffs on them. And if Corey Kluber leads the league at 16% and Danny Salazar is at 20% since returning, it tells you that they got two pretty good starters right there. That's not to mention Carlos Carrasco, who is also awesome. So their top three starters when healthy, which they are right now, mind you. Kluber, I guess, kind of has a bit of a neck thing, but, you know, he's starting today. He's pitching really well. So their top three guys are disgusting. And they also added Bradley Zimmer, you know, from AAA. He's been playing really well at the top of their order. They should get Jason Kipnis back at some point. Lonnie Chisenhall should come back. As they get healthier, they're going to get even better. And honestly, I think it's a testament to how good they are that they're 9 games above 500 despite all the injuries they have had kind of across the board. So if they can get through the Miller injury, if they can get through Josh Tomlin, you know, they're kind of thin rotation right now, they're going to be fun. So I still have a lot of hope for Cleveland. I think that they are the one thing that's preventing me from saying that Houston is a lock to make it to the World Series. But that's going to be a really fun series, because I do think that in the pitching department, which matters so much in the postseason, Cleveland has a pretty definitive edge.
Jim Son is kind enough to join us this afternoon. I wanted to finish up talking some fantasy football. It is right around the bend, preseason underway, the Hall of Fame game between the Cowboys and the Cardinals. And I'm sure there are some lunatics who have already had fantasy drafts held. I'm wondering, actually, let me backpedal. Have you partaken in a fantasy football draft yet?
Yeah, I had two back in, when was it? It was probably back in June, I think. They were for in a magazine, so like you kind of had to have them out early just because they needed to publish. So those are a little bit early. I prefer to go as late as possible just because I want as much information. I've already lost one guy to IR on both teams, so we're starting off hot here, Mitch.
So it wasn't like there were high stakes involved in the drafts you took part in June. They were for a magazine. I'm
right.
Thinking of the people who are wagering something large in their fantasy football leagues, and they've already held their drafts. It makes me cringe a little bit because we've got all these preseason games, training camp practices, and there are guys that are going to go down. Like you said, you already have a couple on IR.
Yeah, thanks, Kenneth Dixon. I appreciate that one for sure. But, yeah, it's definitely tough. I mean, if you have something on the line, and I have my credibility, which really doesn't count for anything at this point, but that's one thing on the line for me. But outside of that, really nothing of substance. There are people, though, who draft starting in February. There are these things called best ball drafts where you can draft pretty much whenever you want, and those are really fun. So there are a lot of people who have drafted already. It does make it difficult, given all the stuff that transpires in training camp, and I've already had to change my rankings pretty drastically because of what has happened during training camp. But, you know, I do understand the people who do go heavy right away.
I wanted to start on a Vikings note, fantasy football related. What are you and the folks at NumberFire thinking for Dalvin Cook, and how much does Latavius Murray and his availability whenever he gets to the field affect what Dalvin Cook could do numbers-wise in fantasy football from your guys' perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I keep moving Dalvin Cook up my rankings just based on Latavius Murray's health and based on, you know, other factors at play. I think the Riley Reiff injury or the uncertainty around what's going on with him right now, that does worry me a tinge, because the offensive line is always going to be a factor in Minnesota. But, you know, it just seems like it's trending towards Dalvin Cook being a big factor in this offense. And the other thing you have to do is you have to, you know, read what the coaches are doing. You know, what they did and, you know, what Rick Spielman did was trade up to get Dalvin Cook in the draft. And they got their guy in the second round. That says to you that they're pretty all in on this guy. There wasn't a lot of guaranteed money shelled out to Latavius Murray either. So I think this all kind of points towards Dalvin Cook being a big contributor in the offense. The question then is going to be, does he get the passing down work, or does that go to Jerick McKinnon? Because that's going to play a huge role for fantasy. If Dalvin Cook winds up getting that passing down usage on the field consistently, then it's going to be really hard not to love him. It's going to get costly very quickly. But honestly, at this point, I can understand why that's happening.
In fantasy terms, standard league, PPR leagues, when it's all said and done, will Stephon Diggs, if he stays healthy, do you view him, I guess not when it's all said and done, we'll talk about going into the year, do you view him as a top 10 wide receiver in fantasy football?
No, and he's not being drafted as such either. He's being drafted now around, I think it's wide receiver 30, so he's pretty low on the boards. I have him at 25, but I can honestly see putting him higher. And the only reason that I have him lower is because I'm a pretty big Adam Thielen believer. I loved, you know, what he did last year, and it seems like the Vikings are trying to throw the ball deep more often this year, at least based on what I've read from them in training camp. If that happens, Thielen last year was the best deep threat on the team, and he was one of the best deep threats in the entire league. So I think that the only reason I'm not higher on Stephon Diggs than other people is because I believe in Adam Thielen, which is a good thing for Sam Bradford. It's a good thing for that entire offense. If they can have two really good receivers, plus Kyle Rudolph, plus an improved offensive line, this offense could do a lot of things. So I think that Diggs is going to wind up being an undervalued fantasy asset. I think that I'm still higher on him than where his average draft position is right now. But my love for Adam Thielen also helps kind of, you know, keep things a little bit in check too.
We'll finish up with a couple of points. Instead of your top quarterbacks heading into the season from a fantasy football perspective, again, how about a couple of names, Jim, quarterbacks that you think could have breakout seasons?
I don't think you can call him a breakout because he's been good each of his first 2 years as a starter. But for whatever reason, people refuse to draft Tyrod Taylor in their leagues. He is currently the 16th quarterback coming off the board. Even though over the past 2 years, he has been awesome when he's been in Buffalo, you have to think about the situation, too. They just fired Rex Ryan. He's no longer there, meaning that their offense likely won't be as run-heavy as it's been in the past. That can only lead to good things for Tyrod Taylor. He had Sammy Watkins healthy. They drafted Zay Jones in the draft. They've got a very good offensive line, and LeSean McCoy's there. That offense is very good. It will score touchdowns. So Tyrod Taylor, I can't call him a breakout guy at quarterback just because he's done it before, but for whatever reason, people refuse to react to it. So I kind of think from a fantasy perspective, you know, looking at guys who are going to outperform their ADP, Tyrod Taylor is the first one who leaps out to me saying, why is this guy going as low as he is right now?
We'll wrap it up on this. I'm going to put you on the spot. If you were to have the number one pick in a standard league and then the number one pick in a PPR league, who would you take first in those drafts? Perhaps the same guy. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's Le'Veon Bell for both, no matter what, just because if you look at what he did last year when he came off of that suspension, he was their number two receiver, and he was one of the most used running backs in the entire league. So when you combine those two things together, yes, it's going to make him heads and tails and leaps and bounds above everyone else from a PPR perspective. But even in standard, he gets so much volume via receiving yardage and rushing yardage, and that offense could be very, very good this year with Martavis Bryant potentially being back. It's really hard for me to go elsewhere. I think David Johnson is very much defensible as that top selection, but Le'Veon Bell is going to be my guy whenever I have that first overall pick this year.
Go to NumberFire to find all of his work. He is Jim Sonnis, and Jim, as always, thank you for the time. It's appreciated.
Thank you, Mitch. I appreciate it. Enjoy the fair. We'll talk to you again soon.
Brandon Warren of Zone Coverage will join us next to put a bow on the show right here on The Blitz.